On to item 10, presentation from staff and Kate, excuse me, did someone, Scott?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I intended to make it actually before Jerry made his motion, but I just wanted to say, I think it's really good practice to memorialize longstanding agreements or customs, in any of that, you know, for purposes of institutional memory. I think it's a great idea. So I wanted to compliment staff for taking the initiative with the county to you know, to get that lined up. I think it's very important. So.
I agree, Scott. You know, working for an agency where a lot of the thing is just, oh, past practice, it is nice when you bring new people on to be able to document. So I totally agree with you. And with that, we'll move on to item 10, presentation from staff and Acadian managers regarding potential commitment to
Mr.
Acadian.
Chairman? With Scott's comments in mind, is staff aware of any other similar arrangement that we might want to also memorialize?
Video too?
Yes, we are aware of other employers that have different due dates. They're not as lengthy, I guess, of an adjustment as the county. But we are working with those employers, and you'll be seeing additional items like this on agendas going forward, because our goal is to have an agreement, a written agreement with every single employer, even if it's just confirming what the regulations say. So we have clear expectations.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Christina. Again, on to item 10. Tim, is this your item?
This is a quick sound check for me. Can everyone hear me okay as well?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, so today we're presenting in a potential investment to the board with Acadian Asset Management into their multi-asset absolute return strategy with the acronym MARS. This is going to be part of our risk diversifying program. And as you'll recall, this has been a long-term build out for us. And the reasons for that is, you know, this is probably the most challenging portion of the FFP construction process. The liquidity is fairly operational, and we know what the asset class is that matches up to that in terms of short-term liquidity. Long-term growth allocations are very familiar to us as investors in terms of equities and real estate development and that sort of thing, and private equity and various other asset classes. But within risk diversifying, we really took a look at this and said we wanted this to be both a small anchor to windward relative to the growth portfolio, and really intended to be kind of a more liquid piece that we could use for rebalancing when we saw equity market stress, such as what we experienced in February, March and April of this year. And so we look for a low correlation to the growth portfolio. We look for liquidity during periods of market stress, and we look for a positive real return, because we know we don't want this to be a long-term drag on the overall results of the portfolio. Now, there are very few strategies that actually set out with those goals in mind. So what we look for is strategies that, when they're pursuing their own approach, tend to overlap with our goals there. To date, we've stocked this portfolio with the AFL-CIO Housing Income Trust, which has government guaranteed mortgages in it. So the government guarantee provides the safety, the income stream provides a positive real return, and it's liquid because it's tradable. So that's something that overlaps with our goals there. We also have the parametric defensive equity. It's a volatility risk premium strategy. So it looks to sell insurance to the market, collect that insurance premium, and have it be differentiated from the market stream, but with a little bit more correlation there. So we always know that one's, you know, it sits on the edge of what we want this portfolio to do. And then we had previously had the Wellington diversified inflation hedging strategy in here that was ultimately wound down in April. So we have been looking for additional strategies for the risk diversifying program for a number of years, and we have been tracking a number of these absolute return strategies that were launched. And a lot of these came out in the 2016, 2017 timeframe. We thought they were very interesting in that they used primarily futures. They were very liquid. They were systematically implemented. So they were using quantitative models to capture behaviors that were expressed in the marketplace. And they looked promising, but they were brand new. And so this will be the first time we're presenting one of these absolute return strategies, or it's in a liquid, relatively low cost structure to the board. They were now about 3+ years into this, and we're starting to see some behaviors come out of these that we were finding very interesting. We'd previously taken a look at the back tests and said, these look fantastic. None of that's live. So we need to see how to sample behavior to confirm the back tested behavior. And so I think, you know, you should expect to see a few more of these strategies come forward over the next 2 years or so. But this was the first one there. So just to highlight the Acadian strategy a little bit, Son, can you give me presenter status so I can bring up my memo? Just give him a moment there. Perfect. Let's get rid of that. So you've all got a copy of my memo in front of you there, and really it's my team's memo as well. But I want to highlight a few things in the presentation there. So Acadian Asset Management is a very large quantitatively oriented firm. They've been running quantitative equities for quite some time. It's a $90 billion firm based out of Boston. They really took the initiative to say, you know, to move beyond equities. They wanted a multi-asset class team rather than try to build that out of the existing equity teams that which had their own, you know, biases and own way of implementing things. They decided to launch a brand new team that was kicked off in 2016 with the hiring of Ilya Fiegelman. Ilya spent about close to 2 years building out a team of quantitative researchers and academics and traders that would be dedicated to multi-asset class, not just the equities, trading across equities, fixed income, currencies, and various other asset classes, and launched the Mars strategy in November of 2017. So we think this is a unique strategy in that what they're trying to do is find small behavioral pricing discrepancies in the marketplace and allocate to a vast number of these. There's typically 100-ish trades in the portfolio at any one point in time, and that could be between equities and fixed income, equities and currency, within currency pairs. So there's a lot of very small behavioral pricing discrepancies that they're looking to capitalize on in the marketplace. And then on top of that, they're doing fairly constant iterative rebalancing in terms of which one of these factors, which one of these trades, which one of these pairs is working better at a point in time, and kind of leaning into the ones that are more indicative of, it really looks like something is out of whack here, let's lean into that one, or this one looks like, you know, the market opportunity is closed on us a bit, let's downplay those. So there's a lot of individual idiosyncratic trades in the portfolio. We think it fits the needs of the risk diversifying sub-portfolio, and I want to take a look at a couple of tables and slides in the memo here. First up is on page 3 of the staff memo, table 1. We take a look at the performance of the Mars strategy here relative to the risk diversifying sub-portfolio and then a couple of equity indices. Over the live period, so going back to November 2017, and this is up through the end of the first quarter here. And we take a look at this and say, relative to what we had in place, what are we getting if we bring in Mars on a pro forma basis? And what we're getting here is a positive return enhancement. The volatility isn't moving a whole lot, but we're getting a pretty solid bump up in the Sharpe ratio over most periods of time. So you'll see in 2018, portfolio, the Mars portfolio returned 2.5% and generated a Sharpe ratio of about 0.42, clearly better than what we had in our portfolio at that time. 2019, a period when the equity markets were in a strong rally mode, this still generated a 10.3% return, so it's keeping up somewhat more during equity market rallies. And then when we have equity market sell-offs, such as we saw in the first quarter, we're still seeing a small positive return out of this portfolio. So it's fitting that return profile behavior that we're looking for here. And then on the correlation side, if we turn to page 7 of the memo, over rolling 3-year periods, we're seeing a relatively modest to quite low correlation to the S&P 500, and the S&P 500 is simply used here as the broad indicative index for growth allocation. We're ranging from a high of about 0.4 to a low of about negative 0.2, so pretty uncorrelated to the equity markets. And if we take a look further on page 8, we take a look at that in terms of on a whole wrapped up basis, what does this look like relative to a broad array of various indices? And we're seeing relatively no correlation to most of the investable segments that we use in the portfolio today. Also, if we take a look at the bottom of that, we compare it to our total fund and each one of our sub portfolios, and we're seeing correlations below 0.3 for all of those. So it looks like a good diversifier. So return enhancer and a diversifier. And then if you think back to the risk diversifying stated program goals, the last thing is it's got to be liquid. We need to be able to use this for rebalancing. And so this one's a little bit harder to test in real time, but if we take a look at slide or page 11 of the memo, it does have monthly liquidities with 30 days advance notice. So you know, it is a structure that we can use to fund into, draw down against when we want something for rebalancing there. So we think we found something that fits the stated programmatic goals of risk diversifying program. It's an enhancement to the program where we know we've had some return challenges there. This one, at least on a historical basis, would be a return enhancer, and it fits the liquidity profile. That's a very brief synopsis of the strategy and our process and what we're looking for there. But let me pause and see if there's any questions from trustees before I ask Acadian to present.
Tim, were there other, I'm sorry, Tim, were there other schemes that you were looking at, that other managers and so forth, that had a similar strategy as this one, and how did they compare?
There are additional strategies that are similar to this one. I don't necessarily want to get into the compare and contrast, because a lot of those are even newer, so we're still in the research process on those. If we get to a comfort level, we may bring those forward for additional inclusion. We're certainly not done building out the risk diversifying program, even if the board approves the Acadian allocation today. So I would expect we currently have one additional strategy in the research pipeline and two others that we're watching. There's various others that we rejected. For a lot of different reasons. Could have been liquidity. Some of these can be gated. If gated means they can block redemptions, that's more of a traditional hedge fund structure. That kind of defeats the purpose of this. If it's not able to be redeployed, it loses some of its efficacy in terms of the FFP construct and our ability to move between sub portfolios and rebalance. And then some of them rely more on physical security, so they're going to have higher trading costs, or you could get into issues of a particular sector being out of favor. This one was a little bit more higher level. Can we capture at low cost, can we capture liquid versions of pricing discrepancies? And so it fit the mold that we were looking for there. Hopefully that helps.
Tim, this is John. Let me ask one more question having to do with the monthly with 30-day advance notice.
Right.
Is there any provision that allows that to be suspended?
The provision is that the redemptions can be restricted for the first 180 days of the initial investment. So, they can impose basically explicit trading costs on us for the 180 days. We have had discussions with the firm about the rationale for that and how we might approach that, but that's really the only strong restriction there's no hard lock, there's no gating abilities here, so that's kind of how we got comfortable on that front.
Okay.
Anything else for Tim before we bring in our guests?
Yeah, sorry, just one question. I see on page 6 at the bottom, you know, standard deviation is somewhere around 6%. Can you just place that in context when folks are, say, a year or 2 years from now looking at the return stream? Do you expect the strategy to perform more like a kind of a core bond portfolio, or do you expect the strategy to be more volatile like an annual portfolio?
In today's yield environment, that's a little bit difficult to answer, but in terms of a historical context, I think you're referring to?
Yeah.
Sure. So this has a stated performance goal of cash plus 5%. And you're going to have, obviously, a variability around that. Nobody gets that level of precision there. But we are talking more volatile than a typical core fixed income portfolio has been historically, but certainly far less than what we're talking about in the equity or commodity space. So, you know, we are stepping out a little bit on the risk spectrum there, slightly, but, you know, it's gonna be closer to core fixed income than it will be to the S&P 500. And we've seen that in terms of the historical correlations, in terms of the historical levels of volatility seen in the back test as well.
That's great. I like the strategy as a kind of a gateway into other quantitative systematic strategies like this. One thing I wanted to kind of highlight was the fact that you're getting a pretty favorable fee, which is nice from the management fee perspective. I'm wondering for you, as you kind of look at the universe of these strategies that are very quantitative, take a lot of resources to run from their end. You know, they're paying for a lot of different data streams, a lot of constant research. How do you kind of balance the idea that you're paying a relatively favorable fee their cash here for you? It's kind of a lower AUM product right now, but they need to make a lot of investments on their end to product kind of at the forefront of that kind of data war, algorithm war to keep generating.
Yeah, you broke up a little bit there, but I think I got the gist of it. We're certainly coming into this at a favorable fee of 50 basis points on the management fee here and operating costs that we expect to decline over time as more investors come into this. You know, I think this is something where if this was a brand new team that was starting up shop, we would have a lot more concerns about the economic viability of, you know, somebody who had high fixed costs trying to scale up here. This is where we can get more comfort by having the backing of the larger Acadian organization, somebody who's got, you know, a long history in the space, who understands quantitative style investing. And, you know, the Acadian writ large has backed a multi-year runway for this new multi-asset class strategy team and given them, the budget to build out, and certainly so early years, it is a cost center rather than a profit center for the firm. But as we scale this, and we do think this is readily scaled, and we have been talking with other investors about their views of this space, we do think this is something that's going to be, more money's going to be moving into this space. So we still look at this and say there's a multi-year runway of backing from the larger Acadian organization, coupled with investor interest that should be able to scale this team up fairly quickly here. Now that they've kind of got, a lot of these strategies, you need a 3-year track record before there's a lot of institutional interest. So this tends to be kind of an inflection point coming up right now. But hopefully that addressed your questions.
Yeah, that's
great.
Anything else for Tim? Okay, seeing none. Tim, do you want to introduce our guest?
Sure. I'm going to turn it over now to Son, if you could take away my presenter status and give it to Andrew Miller. Andrew Miller of Acadian is going to introduce his firm and the team presenting today, including Ilya Fiegelman and Clifton Hill. So with that, Andrew, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Let's see. All right. Thanks very much, Tim. You guys hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you.
Great, thank you. Just getting the screen set up so that I can make sure I'm doing this the right way. Excellent. Well, Tim, thank you for the great introduction. Members of the board, Mr. Chairman, thank you all for the opportunity to meet with you here and discuss the Acadian Multi-Asset Absolute Return Fund, or what we, as we call it, MARS, in a world of acronyms. We appreciate your time and acknowledge that these are unique circumstances, meeting like this, and so thank you for your flexibility. By way of brief background, my name is Andrew Miller. I'm a member of the America's Client Group at Acadian, and I've had the pleasure of working at Acadian for 16 years now. My work is focused on U.S. public pension funds, just like Contra Costa County. Also with me today are two friends and colleagues from the Multi-Asset Absolute Return Fund team, Ilya Fiegelman and Clifton Hill. And I'll ask Ilya to share a little bit more about the team here in a moment, but Ilya is the director of Multi-Asset Class Strategies, which you can consider as the platform which the Multi-Asset Absolute Return Fund sits on. So as the director, Ilya leads the team, is responsible for portfolio management as well as oversight. And as Tim mentioned, was the first actual employee on that team and built it out. Ilya has a wealth of experience here in the multi-asset arena, having joined us from AllianceBernstein, where he was a research director and portfolio manager. Clifton Hill is a portfolio manager on the team and has a really interesting background. I think you'll enjoy hearing from him. He was previously at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, as well as Tudor Investments. These hold roles in global macro strategy, as well as portfolio management. So we've discussed an agenda with Tim where we can spend a brief moment to make an introduction to the firm for those of you that we've not had a chance to meet with, and then get into the investment process, perhaps answer some of the questions that you've already raised or any others. But I'll be clear, this is your time. We're happy to spend it as you would like, and we welcome your questions throughout. If you'd like to start, if I can, and you guys are all seeing the screen here on page 3, in the materials, the Acadian Organizational Review. I have a brief update. This is a snapshot of the firm as of the end of May. And just to reiterate a few things that Tim said, Acadian has been in the systematic investment business for 34 years. And we continue to operate today with the same investment philosophy, which the firm was founded on back in 1986. So our mission is singular, to be the most useful resource for investment insight and success for our partners. I can say, having been with the firm for 16 years, as I noted, I truly think we have an extraordinary team and really a world-class investment culture. Tim shared a little bit of the background. The multi-asset program really builds on Acadian's decades-long experience in the systematic investment world. While it started in equities today, we have a really interesting program and a lot of momentum here in the systematic macro space. Well, we're focused in Boston, Massachusetts. We have partners all over the world, and many, including many in California as well. I'd also note, we have, of the $90 billion in assets under management you see there on the pie chart, over 30% of that is with US public pensions like Contra Costa. Public pensions have always been an important part of Acadian. Our longest standing client today, it goes back to the late 80s, is a US public pension fund. And we have a number of those clients that have been partners for over 25 years. I'll pause there, and if there are questions, happy to take those. Otherwise, ask Ilya to share a little bit of background on the team and their backgrounds.
Andrew, you might indicate if you have any 37 Act plans. We are one of 20 of those types of governmental plans in California.
Yes, indeed we do. And we do work with a number of the other Sacramento County plans, including those in Orange County, San Mateo, and similar. So happy to share more details on that, but we're familiar with the Act and the conference, I should say.
Any other trustee questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, Please continue.
Great. Thank you, Andrew, and good morning, everyone. And thank you all for providing us an opportunity to present Acadian's multi-asset absolute return strategy and how it could add value to Contra Costa's beneficiaries. Now, I joined Acadian in January 2016 with a mandate to build a state-of-the-art systematic multi-asset investment process and corresponding team. The majority of the team members that you see here on this page have joined Acadian by the summer of 2016. So we have been together for 4 years now. Currently, the team is 17 persons strong and is fully dedicated to this multi-asset effort. We are structured around our investment process, which is quantitative and systematic and based on macroeconomic and fundamental factors and themes. To facilitate this investment process, our team has a diverse set of skill sets. We have very strong mathematicians and programmers. We even have a chess grandmaster in the team who is obviously quite strong technically. Now, to complement these strong technical skill sets, we have portfolio managers, Clifton being one of them, who have strong expertise in the macro environment and the fundamentals of assets and asset classes. So Clifton, maybe you can provide a little more color about your background and how it fits in with Acadian's investment process.
Sure. Thank you, Ilya, and thank you to the board for having us. As Andrew mentioned, I started at the Federal Reserve Bank, the central bank, which has been a quite useful experience in the past number of years, given that the central bank has been very involved in a lot of markets. I then moved to a macro hedge fund, Tudor Investment Corporation, where I spent 15 years in various roles, market strategy, portfolio manager. I joined Acadian's multi-asset team in October of 2018, and I really studied the process with fresh eyes, almost like a consultant. I really liked how the multi-asset team was able to capture many things that I learned over my career at the central bank and at the macro hedge fund with some of the best investors and minds in the world. And they systematize it into a successful, dynamic, and economic intuitive process. It's very important to me that the models really show the economic intuition in which we're investing. I really appreciate that our models don't get stuck with one big idea, but rather are dynamic and diversifying and shift with different market environments. We'll show you that throughout the presentation.
Thanks, Clifton. So it is very important to me to have a team that avoids groupthink, whose members bring different perspectives to the table. However, it's just as important that everyone on the team has the same investment philosophy, which is systematic, but based on macro and fundamentals. Our multi-asset investment process is holistic and takes into account various interactions of different asset classes. And our team as a whole has deep expertise in every asset class that we invest in, from equities to bonds, to currencies, to commodities, and to options of volatility. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have on the team or the investment process before I hand it back to Andrew.
Any trustee questions? Not hearing any, so please continue.
Thank you. I have moved to page 6 in the materials. I mentioned in my opening comments that Acadian operates today with the same investment philosophy as at our founding. And I've put that here on the top of the page, and I want to make a few quick comments about it. And I think it's important framing for what you're going to hear later. Broadly, Acadian believes that markets are inefficient, and these inefficiencies are born out of behavioral mistakes that investors of all kinds make across all asset classes. Furthermore, we think that fundamental insights, those that really drive our views on markets, that those are best managed and captured using a systematic process, one that's really objective in its views. And finally, any successful investment program must be dynamic. And we've had some great examples of that here in Q1 of this year so far, in the wake of the market drawdowns in March and April. And we'll talk more about that in a moment.
Question for you. Wanted to ask, in terms of market inefficiencies caused by behavioral errors, I mean, it's widely reported that there's so much automated triggered kind of trading that occurs in the public markets. I'm curious, are the behavioral errors you're speaking of herd mentality, or is it bad planning or program software trading? What's the behavioral error you're targeting?
Sure, Ilya, perhaps you'd like to share a bit more about some of the underlying.
Yeah. No, happy to. So there's a wide array of behavioral errors that have been kind of documented in the academic literature. I can kind of point out to a few of them. You know, there is some herd mentality out there where, you know, if an asset is hot, everyone kind of just rushes into it without really looking at the fundamentals. We've seen that happen in various asset classes kind of throughout our careers. The other thing I count is part of behavioral errors, kind of asymmetric information into the markets, which is not everyone has access to all the information out there instantaneously to make an informed decision. And being a systematic strategy, we can take advantage of that. We can get a lot of this information real time, systematize that, and make a decision based on that. And so there's not a particular one particular behavioral efficiency that we're trying to address. We're trying to address a broad set of them in a systematic manner.
Thank you.
I just note, Tim's pointed this out, the objectives of the Mars strategy, it's really a diversifying return pattern, which is not related or not correlated to growth assets. So in our live history, our relationship or correlation to equity has been just about zero. And we think that is a great diversifying benefit for our clients. The other part of that also mentioned is from a return perspective, is a return expectation of about 5% above cash. With that, I'll turn to page 7. For Ilya to share a little bit more in terms of the highlights here before we get into the details more.
Great. Now, as we discussed, our multi-asset investment process is systematic and based on macro and fundamental information. We also incorporate alternative or unique data sources that are not widely used in systematic strategies. Specifically, we have over 300 signals of factors that forecast over 100 assets across 5 asset classes. So moving to page 8 to show our opportunity set. We take both long and short positions across all of our 5 asset classes. For equities, we do not pick stocks. Rather, we invest in broad equity countries, both in developed and emerging markets. In bonds, we invest in 10-year futures of developed market governments. We invest in liquid developed and emerging currencies. Now, commodities is a true differentiator for us. We model each commodity sector based on its respective fundamental drivers and incorporate many signals that use alternative data. In our options of volatility strategy, we have both a return-seeking and a protective component. Now, we dynamically adjust each component, which really helped in the first quarter of this year as we were materially overweight the protective component and underweight the return-seeking component. So as markets sold off, that really helped to protect the portfolio. Now, finally, I want to mention is that the majority of portfolio risk is in relative value, market neutral selection, more idiosyncratic positions, as Tim mentioned. For example, we can be long US equities, short German equities, or in the petroleum space, we can be long WTI crude while being simultaneously short Brent crude. And we only take modest directional long or short positions in the aggregate asset classes. So happy to answer any questions here about the opportunity set before I hand it back to Andrew to talk about live performance.
Any trustee questions? Seeing none, please continue.
briefly here at the outset, we wanted to illustrate for you the live performance of the Mars strategy, and particularly so relative to equity indices, since I noted that one of the standing objectives of the strategy is to diversify versus risk assets like public equities. So what you're seeing here is on the bottom side, bottom of this, we have the returns for the MSCI World, a common global equity index, positive returns on the right, negative on the left. And we've on the left-hand side axis, the Mars returns, positive up top, negative below. And we've mapped the Mars live returns against equity market. The real point here, as we have noted a couple times, the diversification benefit of the strategy, you'll note there's no discernible pattern to the Mars returns and to what equity markets are doing. And that, again, is one of the objectives of the strategy, and we'll talk more about why that is. So I can point out a couple data points, which we'll get to later, but this is really driven by a diverse set of exposures and a diverse set of assets that drive this consistent return without any pattern. For example, you can see in February of 2020, doesn't seem that long ago, equity markets were down dramatically, nearly 10%, and the Mars strategy was up modest. This contributed, of course, to our positive first quarter. On the other hand, over here, January of 2019, equity markets, were up quite strongly, and the Mars strategy was down modestly. So again, we'll keep coming back to this theme, but that there's no real relationship to the Mars returns and risk assets like public equities. I should note I was on page 9 if I didn't before. With that, I'm going to move forward to page 11, where Ilya can discuss further the investment process.
Sure. Our holistic systematic portfolio construction is driven by our return in risk forecasts, which Clifton will describe in some detail in the next few slides. Now, portfolio construction also incorporates strategy objectives and risk management features that address both foreseeable and unforeseeable risks. Now, the latter is very important, as many risks cannot be anticipated. Therefore, we have many features in portfolio construction, such as hard constraints on any exposure, long or short, of any asset, that mitigate potential losses due to unforeseeable risks. Now I'll hand it over to Clifton to describe our return and risk models in some detail. And we were on page 11.
Thank you, Ilya. So on page 12, we have the return model design. What are we attempting to do? At the heart of it, the multi-asset absolute return is about forecasting returns. Specifically, and this is very important, all the signals in the return models need to have fundamental, economic, and market rationale. Remember, this is important to me with my background. Factors and signals that give us the forecast need to make market and investing sense. We are trying to forecast what drives the prices of 100 plus assets available to us. Let me give you a specific example. In natural gas, for a natural gas forecast, we're using a number of inputs so we can understand what the price of natural gas will be in the future. We look at supply through natural gas production and inventory, pipelines, demand through consumption. So think if the forecast drops to 0 degrees in the Northeast, what is the consumption and demand going to be for all the individuals in the Northeast? Furthermore, look at weather, like warm or cold winter, El Nino, La Nina. We look at seasonality and then also market positioning. How's all the other investors and market participants positioned? With all these inputs, it helps us to forecast the price of natural gas. Now, natural gas is just one example of how we use the fundamental economic inputs to forecast our 100 plus assets.
Question.
Secondly, sure.
Question for you. So in turn, just staying on the natural gas paradigm for a moment, probably several weeks ago or at some point you were forecasting the market. And I guess my question to you is, did you foresee the Duke Energy decision or the Chesapeake decision? And if so, how did you incorporate that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So basically, we're not attempting to make forecasts on specific companies and the policy decisions made. But what happens is we're actually capturing, we have the data of actual supply of pipelines, and therefore we pick up those decisions immediately as it's reflected in the data. So it's almost like that policy decision is similar to a weather forecast shifting next week. So Sunday evening, we get an updated forecast. Sometimes it says, if you're coming into the weekend, the forecast is 40 degrees. You get the Sunday update, and it says it's going to be 10 degrees. So all of a sudden, the model gets that instantaneous data and starts to shift the forecast to address this new change. So just to answer your question directly, we did not anticipate the actual company decisions, but we capture it through the demand and supply data.
Thank you.
Clifton, if I can add on, add to Scott's question. Obviously, decision on Dominion and Duke purchased by Berkshire, together with at least several other big pipeline projects being abandoned or basically put on hold, suggests some fairly major changes in the cost of transporting energy in the United States. Is that something you're looking at? Is that an example? And if so, how are you responding to that in your investment strategy?
Yeah, that's a great question. Basically, what happens in those types of decisions is that it is captured in the supply and the future supply in the models. So basically, we've been turning longer natural gas as a result of some of these decisions cutting off production. So even though some of the demand is weak, and then that's taken into account the seasonality is changed as we're in the summer, it's still looking at what the supply is going to be going forward. And those data points are updated, not just current supply, but future supply. And that it starts to address the factors in our models and change our forecast.
Thank you.
Sure.
I would just add that this is one example we use to draw out the investment thesis, if you will. And in a few more slides, we'll have a look at what the live portfolio looks like, and you'll get a sense for the sizing by risk of a position like natural gas. In other words, there are going to be lots of small components, lots of small ideas like this that add up to that diversifying return stream.
And yes, and I'll just add, the things you mentioned are exactly the fundamental factors that we're attempting to capture, that many in the market cannot get it instantaneously or can't adjust their forecast. I'll just move on here to diversification. Ilya has mentioned this, you'll hear it as a consistent theme. We're diversifying not only across assets, but asset classes, across factors and themes. But the portfolio is not solely exposed to a handful of concentrated risk. When I was at a macro fund, we took a lot of concentrated risk. Without diversification. What we're attempting to do here is have less concentrated risk and be very diversified. And then that leads to what we're also trying to do is be very defensive. We definitely are return seeking in trying to produce great performance, 5+ cash, but we really want to do well when equity markets falter. Now the next page will show you on 13, we'll roll up the different themes. So this is a live forecast of developed market equities on page 13. Let me lay out the page for you. First, the colors are the various themes or factors we use to get our forecast. They are dynamic and change through time, through regime shifts. All the themes and factors that you see there listed equal the black line, which is our positive, negative, or neutral forecast. Now on the x-axis is the dates from January 2018 through May 2020. On the vertical line or the y-axis is how positive or negative we are of the asset, in this case, developed market equity. Now let's go through a few factors or themes which are described by the color. The red represents the stimulus theme. You see the bright red there. That's looking at developed market bond yields. So as we've seen, bond yields have fallen to historically low levels. We started the year with the 10-year at 1.9%, and it's fallen to a low of 31 basis points, and now is approximately 0.65. So really a big shift with yields coming down. The stimulus is looking to capture that to understand the effects it is on equities. The purple represents credit risk. Now that's how easy or difficult it is for credit used by companies, banks, and individuals to flow through the economic system. Think of it as credit stress. And then the green, light green, is growth. That's looking at sectors within the equity market, like defensives and cyclical, and also some of the economic data to show the economic strength around the world. Next, we're going to look at, so we understand this example more, the end of 2019 into Q1 of 2020, to get a better understanding of how this works in real time. As we know, we ended 2019 on a very positive note, and that is shown through our forecast to start 2020. The stimulus, which I explained before, is positive. The valuations, which we look at the valuation of equities but versus cash that you may get in your savings or checking account. Momentum is positive. And the credit risk, which positive through all of 2019, remains positive. The negative side was just two things, quality in orange, which is our earnings, and growth. As we moved into 2020 in January, you could see January and February, you could see the forecast, the black line, fall quickly and dramatically into negative territory. This is all the factors shifting. The sentiment in peach falls quickly as equity prices fall. The credit risk, which had been positive for all of 19, shifts quickly to one of the most negative contributors, while the growth and quality, which were already marginally negative, become more negative. And one factor I didn't mention is risk compensation. And that's trying to measure within the volatility markets how complacent or adjusted the markets are. Volatility spiked to unprecedented levels, so that added to the negative contribution. This model stayed negative all the way into early April and then quickly shifted to neutral and then to positive. This shows how dynamic the models are in capturing both the positive returns of 2019, but then the quick shift to a down 30% equity market in Q1 of 2020. This is a rich forecast, but only one of 100 plus assets. We take modest risk in most of these assets. Are there any questions on that page?
Clifton? So if you look at how you take advantage of inefficiencies or opportunities, I mean, with that drop or with the credit risk, how do you jump on that? So you see the dip. How do you act on that to improve performance?
Yes, and that's very important. So basically what happens is the data that we're using for credit risk immediately starts showing stress. So one of the benefits we have is we get to look at all five assets. So when there was a question earlier about catching these behavioral anomalies or inefficiencies, some investors who are just looking at equities can't see the risk coming in many other assets. So we made new highs on February 17th. The equity market clearly had no worry about the coronavirus, but the volatility markets, the credit risk markets, and some of the other markets started to move ahead of that. You even saw petroleum started to sell off. Bonds yields started to come down. So basically, to your question about credit risk, is the data shows the credit risk, which is the purple, shifting and becoming worse, and then that makes our model more negative. And then how that manifested is our positioning starts to shift from positive equity, so our longs throughout the portfolio in various equity markets across the world starts to reduce their long exposure. Some shift short and some get more short and others just reduce the long. So overall our equities, we just bring down the long exposure and on net become more negative on equity. And that's how we're able to capture or at least reduce the losses of equities in Q1. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. So just move on to page 14. The return forecast is very important, and that's how we really try to reach our 5+ cash, or how we can make 10% in 2019. But risk management is very important, and that's integral to our investment process. So we've built a proprietary risk model that forecasts volatilities of the assets, so how the assets move, and the correlations, which is how close they are relative to each other. So the correlation of gold to the US dollar to the equity market, how close do they move together? We do this with all the 100+ assets in our investment universe. The risk forecast incorporates short, intermediate, and long-term dynamics of each asset. So we want to catch the short, quick moves down, like in February of 2020, and also Q4 of 2018, where you'll remember the equity market dropped 15%. We don't want to get head faked or pulled in the false direction. So we look across all three time horizons to get a good picture of what's happening currently. On page 15, which touches on what we talked about on 14, this shows how the risk model captures the big jump in volatility. Look at Q1 of 2020. So you see the huge jump in both short-term, intermediate, and long-term volatility. This is important for your risk model to capture. Many thought Q4 of 2018 was a big increase in risk. At least it felt like that. But it was nothing compared to Q1 of 2020. The volatility in 2020, Q1 2020, eclipsed the move in volatility seen during the financial crisis, which many thought we'd never see again. Why this is important is that as the market risk rise, our models start to take down or reduce our portfolio exposures. Similar to what I was explaining with the DM equity, it reduces the exposures. If there's no further questions, I'll pass on to Ilya for risk budget.
Any trustee questions? Okay, hearing none, please continue.
Thank you, Clifton. So we're on page 16 now. Putting all this together, here's a typical risk budget of the portfolio. Now, this chart shows the percent contribution to total portfolio risk that comes from selection and allocation components of all asset classes. I'd like to highlight a few specific points here. First, the majority of risk comes from selection, which is a relative value market neutral positioning. And only a modest amount of risk comes from directionality or allocation. You can see selection in the light blue and the allocation contribution in the gray. Second, risk is fairly spread out across asset classes, where commodities are somewhat higher and bonds and volatility are somewhat lower. These risk budgets are determined via rigorous quantitative technique that takes into account the diversification of breadth of each asset class. So commodities, for example, have the most breadth. Since there are many commodities in our universe, and commodity sectors tend to be uncorrelated with each other. For example, natural gas, even though it's energy, basically has a zero correlation with the petroleum complex. And finally, selection has the most breadth than allocation, and that's the main reason why it dominates the risk budget. So if we join me on page 17, and here's a snapshot of the details of portfolio risk. The y-axis shows the contribution to risk from each asset for the overall portfolio risk of 7% as of end of May. As you can see, risk is spread out across a diverse set of assets and asset classes, and every asset contributes well than 1% to the overall portfolio risk. Clifton described natural gas in a detailed way, but natural gas only has a very small contribution to the overall portfolio risk, even though it's driven by a very diverse and rich set of factors in the forecast. Same thing with equity markets. So Clifton also showed a detailed forecast of our equity markets, which has many interesting themes and factors, But that one forecast only contributes a modest amount to portfolio risk. The key characteristic of our portfolio is diversification. And you can even see on the right-hand side, there's a lot of assets which are true diversifiers, as their inclusion in the portfolio actually reduces the overall portfolio risk. Now, I will pause here to see if there's any questions about portfolio risk budgets. And if not, I'll hand it over to Andrew and Clifton to talk about kind of the details of our live performance attribution.
Any trustee questions? No one unmuted, so please continue.
Great, thank you. On page 19, we illustrate further this point about diversification, where on a previous slide, I showed you the Mars fund returns versus equities. Here, we're going through the same exercise to illustrate the diversification relative to a number of other assets. So on the previous page, I made the point that there is no discernible pattern between Mars returns and that of the equity market. And you see it above here, where we're measuring correlations with the Mars strategy since its inception to the US equity market. Tim mentioned the S&P 500 previously. Same idea here. It's effectively zero correlation with the US equity market over its history. And then similarly, we show a couple of others. We've been talking about commodities. So down here, you see petroleum. No discernible pattern here between the Mars returns and the returns of petroleum. In fact, the relationship there is effectively negative. So just another nice illustration here, I think on 19, of that diversification benefit. Further, on page 20, we illustrate the live performance since inception in two ways. At the top, month by month, with the objective here of just illustrating this is just a diversifying, consistent return stream. If we plotted it against equities like you've seen before, you would see that. And then down below, we plot a couple of specific time periods, including since inception here below the gray bars, where you see that 3.4% since inception, but critically at about 5.6% risk. Above the gray lines, we plot, as I note, a few periods of market stress in the equity markets, which we can talk about more, Clifton will talk about more in terms of attribution. So while we have the composite return here for the strategy, we also illustrate the world equity returns on the right-hand side. And I'd note that world equity is not a benchmark per se, but again, it's an important component as an objective to diversify from this. So you can see here, as we've talked about in 2018, the fourth quarter, when the strategy was up about 5% on a net basis, and equity markets were down nearly 13%. Similarly, in Q1 of this year, the strategy was up 1% and markets were down nearly 20. So in addition to the positive absolute levels of return, this also provides some flexibility for our clients as it relates to rebalancing in periods of market stress around equities.
Hey, Andrew, I had a quick question. And I think that last point was a good one in that that's basically what the strategy's purpose would be in the portfolio. One of the difficulties I have with kind of understanding sometimes a market neutral or largely market neutral absolute return type strategy is setting expectations for when the strategy should do well, especially, you know, on the prior page, you talked about low correlations over time to different indices. So when I'm looking at this, say, let's say we fund it, and we get into some a little bit more volatility across markets. What should our expectations be for the strategy? When we look at, you know, performance on a quarterly basis, we see broad equity indices are down or up. That kind of sets expectations for other long only strategies we have. We know relative to equity indices, how an active equity strategy hopefully performs. Is it protected or not? They did well or not? But in kind of reviewing this strategy on a quarterly basis, what are we to one expect, and then how are we to kind of evaluate whether the strategy is performing in line with expectations.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. I'll just make one comment, and then perhaps Ilya can add on more relative to expectations. But you know, you should expect that in periods when performance is challenging or challenged in the strategy, that it will be unrelated to any broad market or macro theme. And I think that's one of the important and we think beneficial components of it. But perhaps Ilya, if you'd like to add a little bit more color on that.
Yeah, no, Andrew, that's exactly right. I mean, we've designed the strategy to be uncorrelated to any particular market driver, market theme. Now, in any given month, in any given quarter, two things that are unrelated can move in the same direction. But that doesn't mean there's an economic relationship. That just, you know, two things move in the same direction. But we've designed the strategy to be unrelated to any major market movements. And we've designed it to take advantage of many kind of unrelated, more idiosyncratic positions based on fundamentals. So that is kind of the design in terms of kind of risk return expectations. The way I would think about this is something that has approximately half the risk of equity markets. And, you know, think of drawdowns should have half the drawdowns of equity markets. But we designed it to have the same long-term expected return of equities over a full cycle.
Andrew, got a question if I could. Just help me with the math a little bit on your composite returns net of fees on page 20. Take a look at 2019. For the year, you have two high months of 2.7%. The remainder of the months are either somewhat negative or flat, but it somehow rolls up to a 10.3% return. Help me with the math.
Absolutely. At the highest level, what you're seeing there is the benefits of compounding, so that some of those drawdowns are narrow, or I should say shallow, and so you're getting the compounded benefit of returns through holding on to more of the gains in those 2.7% months, despite the fact that you do have a few, you know, mildly negative months in there.
Yeah, I mean, February, April, June, and July were all months above 7%, all months above 2%. August was at 1%. So that just mathematically ends up being 10% for the year.
Andrew, why do you use the 3-month T-bill as your benchmark?
Ilya, would you like to address that? Is the design?
Yeah, I mean, this is an absolute return strategy, so it's not related to any major market. And so the way we think about this is the opportunity cost of a strategy that's not correlated to anything is cash, and our expectation is 5% above cash over the long term.
So when you're talking about alpha, you're looking at a positive gain over the 3-month T-bill.
Correct.
Okay.
I would just add that, again, important to note that there's no relationship here in objective or in live performance to any other, you know, sort of major market benchmark. And again, by design, therefore, the cash is the most appropriate in our minds, but we show equity as a reference.
So it's the best available, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
These are great questions, and I want to be careful with your time. We do have an exhibit or two to close with relative to performance attribution, if that would be helpful. But again, I know you have a busy agenda and want to be conscious of your time.
If you think it'll be helpful, we could quickly go through them.
Great. With that, I'll turn to slide 22. Clifton, talk us through some of these periods of market stress we've referenced. It'd be great.
Sure. So when looking at page 22, we show the contribution of our diverse asset classes and the monthly performance. So what you're looking at there is green is the equity asset contribution. Gray is our bond market contribution. Blue is the foreign exchange contribution. Purple is the commodity. And the dark blue is the volatility contribution. So with that, we're going to focus on Q4 of 2018 and Q1 of 2020, which are the big down equity market quarter. Let me just give you a backdrop, which I think is important in terms of framing this discussion. Coming into Q4 2018, the Fed had been raising rates late in 2017 and all of 2018. Equity markets were still trending up, although there was some contagion in EM markets over the summer and occasional problems with Italy's debt. In early October of 2018, Chairman Powell of the Federal Reserve Bank signaled the Fed was nowhere near neutral, meaning that the Federal Reserve Bank was going to continue hiking rates. This started and caused the market to have a very poor quarter for equity and overall risk assets. Once again, as we talked about before, the credit spread showed stress, volatility spiked, equities fell, and bond yields rose initially with the Fed's initial comment, but then started to recede as the market started to price in the Fed having to shift its more hawkish or rates higher stance to potentially a more low stance. This sell-off continued all through the whole quarter of Q4 2018, and there was another leg down on December 19th, where the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank said that the balance sheet was going to continue tightening. So therefore, credit was going to remain tight in terms of rates. Equities fell another 6% on the statement on December 19th of 2018. The equity markets bottomed around Christmas time as the markets anticipating the central bank easing and having to retrace their more hawkish comment. The Fed eventually did reverse course in the first week of January 2019, and this started a great year for equity markets. Now, our return, we were able to make gains in every month of Q4 2018. In October, it was all asset classes, aside from volatility. In November, the gains were driven by commodities, where we had a very diversified portfolio, where gains were made in assets such as palladium and platinum and petroleum. No asset contributed negatively from ours in November. In December, we lost in equities, as our model started to anticipate the rebound that was going to happen in January from themes such as stimulus and growth. But the gains were more than offset, but the losses were more than offset through our commodity and bond performance. Something to note is that our bond allocation contributed positively in every month in Q4 2018, as it shifted from short bonds as the 10-year hit 3.25 to long bonds as it fell from 3.25 down to almost 2.5. Another important thing to note about performance is although January in 2019, it rallied 9%, the equity market, bouncing from the Q4 losses, we were only slightly down. This speaks to diversification within factors and assets that can react very well in changing environments. Quickly on to Q1 2020, which is a similar example. We already went through the backdrop earlier, so I'll just speak to more of the drivers. FX, foreign exchange really drove the gains in Q1 2020, contributing positively in every month. We were leaning negatively long the dollar, short many other foreign exchange currencies in many countries, specifically in Latin America and Asia, that already had challenging fundamentals. And this was all just accentuated with the outbreaks of COVID-19. Commodities, once again, were positive this time, 2 out of 3 months. And the reason why commodities had some positive contributions was also very idiosyncratic assets like coffee and cocoa and some industrial metals. In March, our losses were led by equities, as our long equity positions lost more than our negative or negative leaning equity positions. But the portfolio losses were limited in that the gains from our FX and volatility positions offset many of these equity losses. As Ilya mentioned earlier, volatility was our largest positive contributor in March and really helped to diversify and hedge the portfolio as we turned materially positive on protection or basically buying volatility rising. That's kind of the attribution of what happened in those quarters and the contribution across assets. I think what's really important to highlight is how we have multiple assets that can really help in these very challenging environments, and that we can get information from many different assets across the spectrum. There's no further questions. I'll let Andrew end on our live performance to date.
Yes, go ahead and go with the presentation.
Sure. Just to wrap it up, thank you. Just to wrap it up, back one slide to 21. This page, I think, just reinforces some of the points that Clifton's made in that we have a truly diversified process. So we're showing you again live performance here in the two formats we've shown previously, return contribution by asset class and strategy component. You see selection dominating. And on the bottom chart, you can see the contribution from each theme across asset classes. You'll note the majority of themes contribute a modest positive amount, which is a true sign of a diversified investment process. With that, I just note again that this sort of concludes our prepared comments. And I'd note that we would really appreciate the chance to meet with you here under these challenging circumstances. And would really welcome the opportunity to partner with you and your team and perhaps have a chance to visit with you in person someday. So thank you. We'll see if there are questions from here.
Thank you.
Any questions for our guests? I'm not seeing any. So thank you so much for your time in this presentation. We appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Bye now.
Thank you.
Great.